necessary? How is it not true? And if the presumption that structures are every interaction is acceptance of or dramatization of the transcendent value of the individual, even ourselves, then in what manner do we not believe that value to be real? More profoundly, we may ask, at what point must it be admitted that a necessary fiction is true precisely in proportion to its necessity? Is it not the case that what is most deeply necessary to our survival is the very essence of true? Any other form of truth runs counter to life, and a truth that does not serve life is a truth only by an ultimately counterproductive standard, and thereby not fundamentally true. At this point in the Genesis story, we have been barely introduced to God as character. Nonetheless, these inexhaustibly rich opening lines describe the essential nature of the cosmic order, the existence of a process that transforms chaos and possibility into the habitable order that is good, aiming at very good. The proclamation that this process is both fundamental to and superordinate in that creation, the assertion that reality itself depends on it, the insistence that human beings do and should participate in this process, and that the possibility of such participation bestows upon each person divine and ultimate worth and responsibility. Man, and woman too, so miraculously, right at the beginning, are thus formulated in the very image of the divine. Whatever essence typifies or characterizes every human being, the very spirit that makes them both human and valuable, is directly akin to the force that transforms the void into the heavenly garden itself. All of the most functional and desirable places and states of the world, from the microcosm of happy marriage to the integrated community of nation, are predicated both implicitly and explicitly on something much like this presumption. Furthermore, and in a manner that buttresses the central point, the lack of that belief or faith makes the terrible relationships and polities that man can also create the true hell that they far too often become. Do we believe? When we falter in that commitment, catastrophe looms. 1.2. The spirit of man in the highest place. God says to the men and women of his new creation that they are to subdue the earth, notably after they replenish it. This idea has been widely criticized, not least because of its expansion in the next verse, which gives man and woman sovereignty, dominion, over fish, fowl, and every living thing. Those who claim something else should be placed in the superordinate position object vociferously to the ethos encapsulated in these words. It is not man and woman in relationship with God that should be elevated, celebrated, and worshipped, according to such critics. Consider the words of history professor Lynn White, taken from his famous essay of 1967, The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. Especially in its Western form, Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has seen. As early as the second century, both Tertullian and Saint Irenaeus of Lyon were insisting that when God shaped Adam, he was foreshadowing the image of the incarnate Christ, the second Adam. Man shares in great measure God's transcendence of nature. Christianity, in absolute contrast to ancient paganism and Asia's religions, except perhaps Zoroastrianism, not only established a dualism of man and nature, but also insisted that it is God's will that man exploit nature for his proper ends. In antiquity, every tree, every spring, every stream, every hill had its own genius loci, its guardian spirit. These spirits were accessible to men, but were very unlike men. Centaurs, fauns, and mermaids show their ambivalence. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation and to keep it placated. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to to the feelings of natural objects. What is White claiming? That it is immoral to elevate the merely human, that whatever constitutes the ill-defined term nature, or worse, the environment, should be put first and foremost instead of man and woman, society, or human well-being. Such objections, made theoretically on behalf of nature, sound fine, even altruistic and humble. Why should that presumptuous evolutionary accident, man, take center stage? But are in truth the very opposite of these. If nature is placed above man, such that every brook has its transcendent spirit, then man, woman, and child are by necessity placed below nature. This might mean in principle that the wonders of the environment would become rightly valued. In practice, however, it all too often means instead that human beings are given no more shrift than weeds or rats. This inversion of value enables not so much the stewardship of the earth as the exploitation of those deemed no more worthy than the lowest forms of life, exploitation by exactly the sorts of people who eternally step forward to abuse such advantage. A similar moral objection is frequently leveled at the injunction to populate the earth. Be fruitful and multiply, Genesis 1:28. This directive, however, is offered in a very particular context, one characterized by the spirit that has already brought about the order that is good and very good, and that is continuing to do so, not least through the intermediary of man. This means that the human enterprise of creation, including that of family, must be carried out in a manner that is replenishing, as is clearly stated in exactly that verse, implied by those that precede it, and that most truly reflects the spirit of the Creator. Man's dominion over the earth must be, to use a word now tainted by association with ideological force, sustainable, must make what is good still better. Our planet is not to be worked selfishly to exhaustion. A strategy that would render the injunction to be fruitful and multiply meaningless in almost no time, generationally speaking. For this reason, Genesis 2:15 places Adam, the first man, in the eternal garden to dress and to keep it. This garden is Eden, which means well-watered place, and paradise, paradisa, a walled enclosure surrounding nature. This optimized environment is the delicate balance struck between the material world and the social order that best enables each person, more accurately, each couple and then family, to demarcate a section of creation for themselves and then to work and sacrifice to make it part of the order that is good or very good. Later biblical injunctions to periodically rest the land, Exodus 23:11, as well as to care for working animals, are in keeping with this productive and far-seeing sentiment. A righteous man regardeth the life of his beast, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel, Proverbs 12:10. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn, Deuteronomy 25:4. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, Exodus 20:10. The latter passage is particularly telling, in that even those over whom power or excessive authority could be easily exercised are to be given rest. These principles of care reflect the even deeper notion saturating the biblical corpus, which is that the highest of moral effort is exactly what makes the water of life flow, so that even the desert can bloom. To subdue is also not to dominate, and all claims to the contrary be damned. The divine continually opposes the tyrant, as in Exodus 7-14, and warns against even seemingly benevolent kings, 1 Samuel 8:10-18. Further, God is presented, defined, as the spirit that or who punishes even markedly great men, even archetypal leaders of their people who succumb to the temptations of force and compulsion. Numbers 20:12. To top it all off, of course, are the examples first of Job and then of Christ, which will be dealt with exhaustively in a forthcoming work, who abjure the use of force even in the most provocative and desperate of situations. To subdue is, therefore, not to control and command, but to put everything in its proper place, to give everything its subordinate value or due, to order everything hierarchically so that the priorities of attention and action can be established, and to place things so that the world is no longer mere potential or disorder. The fact of this responsibility is stressed in Genesis 2, the second chapter of creation, in which God first formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. Genesis 2:19. This verse implies strongly that the work of creation undertaken by the Logos, or Word of God, was somehow incomplete until differentiated further by man, whose decision in such matters appears strangely final. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all cattle and to the fowl of the air and to every beast of the field. Genesis 2:19. Adam subdues and names. These are the actions or even the essence of human consciousness. And there is more. Given the dependence of being on that consciousness, as being without consciousness is literally inconceivable and perhaps also impossible, consciousness is the essence of that which undergirds being itself. That would be the divine creator of all things, the ineffable reality on which all revealed reality depends. That would be the Word, identified as there in the beginning in Genesis and much later by the Apostle John, John 1:1. The hero, the spirit of Adam, made in the image of the foundational spirit, is the active process of subduing and naming, which is the valuing that makes perception, meaning, and even existence itself possible. That hero eternally confronts the primal chaos, the waters and void over which the Spirit of God moves. That, as of yet formless possibility, is the Great Mother, the matrix from which actuality emerges, the prima materia, the primal matter from which everything tangible and real is most primordially made. And it is the hero who makes it. This means not least that the human beings God created have something both real and vital to occupy themselves with, something that truly matters, even in the cosmic scheme. 1.3, the real and its representation. What could possibly be more real than the facts? First, which facts? And there indeed is the rub. This is why we find the archetypal stories at the base of every well-integrated psyche and every unified community. These stories provide the structure through which we apprehend the facts and communicate the hierarchy of value that lends weight to one fact over another. The great stories reflect the aim that motivates us and provide security to the individual, and which, when shared, constitutes the basis for community. That aim is a prerequisite to the active perception that allows us even to encounter what most truly exists. The stories that are depictions of our aim and our character have a primary reality, not least because even our understanding of the real, even our direct perception of the facts, depends on the a priori existence of these depictions. Are the facts more real than the instrument that allows for the determination of facts? We cannot help but see the world through a story. More precisely, we see the world through a structure that, when portrayed in drama or verbalized, is a story. Even our science has now progressed such that we ever more clearly understand how the language that makes up a story works and why that matters to anyone concerned with stories themselves, particularly in their greatest form. the body of any human language contains within it an empirically derivable coding of meaning, we can map this coding as the statistical relationship between letters, words, phrases, sentences, paragraphs, and so on up the living tree of the logos. A word is identifiable as a word because it fits the mathematical pattern of the relationship between letters that characterizes all comprehensible words. It is this pattern that makes certain non-words plausible, such as vims, blin, and flumptuous, and that enables them to be distinguished at a glance from implausible non-words, such as KJLK and ZXNQ and QWLELRLTL, or even more radically, M4A3S2T1R. Plausible non-words adhere to the sound patterns of the language in which they are created. They possess combinations of consonants and vowels that are both familiar to, say, English speakers and pronounceable in English. In contrast, implausible non-words contain letter combinations that are either unfamiliar or impossible to pronounce in English. We see an analogous situation at higher or more fundamental levels of meaning. Just as there is a calculable probability that a given letter will follow any other given letter, in fact, there's a hierarchy of such probability in that the letter E, for example, is more likely than A to follow any given consonant, but A is more likely than Q, there is a high and calculable probability that any given phrase, and therefore concept, will co-occur or exist in close proximity to a network of other concepts with associated meaning. That set of proximate conceptions are the so-called symbolic associations that help connote rather than denote the meaning of the phrase in question. In a well-constructed story, any given network of such associations is surrounded by other networks of comparative similarity and contrasted with networks of contrasting dissimilarity. This expanding network of associations constitutes the landscape of meaning. At the linguistic level, this landscape contains concepts that are similar or equivalently weighted, or are likely to exist in proximity to one another with a high probability. For example, the word dragon is likely to occur near words or phrases such as fire-breathing, mythical, legendary, creature, serpent, beast, fantasy, folklore, mythology, guardian of treasure. The word witch, near magic, spell, broom, cauldron, familiar, black robe, hat, hex, potion, and coven. The word father, near love, family, support, guidance, role model, mentor, provider, protector, legacy, wisdom, and magic. The word villain, near evil, antagonist, wicked, nefarious, malevolent, despicable, corrupt, malicious, unscrupulous, and diabolical. Beyond the linguistic level, this landscape also exists in the realm of image and behavior. It is easy to bring to mind relevant examples drawn from popular culture. The basilisk, a dragon variant in the second volume of the Harry Potter series, whose gaze killed or at least petrified, as a rabbit is turned to stone by the eyes of a wolf, and whose bite can be cured so mysteriously by the tears of a phoenix. The father, represented by Geppetto in the film Pinocchio, who wishes most devoutly that the son he carves could free himself from the marionette strings that determine his destiny. The attraction of deceit, the temptation of neurotic victimhood, the cheap rebellion of delinquent hedonism, and the figure of the Joker in The Dark Knight, the villain whose perfidy is so deep that he betrays even the ethos of the thief. Such association between images is, if anything, deeper than the analogous association between words, because an image can present a very large number of ideas at once in comparison to the more restricted bandwidth of language. This is perhaps particularly true in the case of moving pictures. The association between images exists because there are patterns of character in the human world of attention and action that exist in relationship to one another in a regular and identifiable way. If this were not true, We could not maintain our proximity to one another or even to ourselves, as the unpredictability that would otherwise reign would prove emotionally intolerable, and we would certainly not be able to cooperate in relation to some shared goal or aim. This pattern of association is how the idea of, say, symbol is best understood. Something that is symbolic of something is not a mere substitution, obscuration, or false replacement in the Freudian repression sense for that thing. It is instead something that brings to consciousness, in word or picture, a host of co-occurring ideas and images, and in that manner fleshes out the relevance, significance, implications, or meaning of what it exists in association with. Someone's pattern of attention and action in the real world can produce the same effect. A new person can be someone reminiscent of an old friend, an old enemy, a sister or brother, or even something more fundamental, more archetypal, something that calls to mind a hero, say, or a villain. We experience such an effect, for example, when we are seized by admiration for someone compelling and charismatic, or by a sense of unease and visceral discomfort, dismay, and disgust. It is the fact that those who affect in such manners are acting out a pattern of spirit that compels us to notice more than is simply there for simple and immediate apprehension, that draws our attention to the possibility that something profound and necessary to understand is playing itself out. Although symbolic meaning has been generally regarded as more or less, or even indefinitely and irreducibly open to interpretation, a notion taken to its final extreme by the kingpins of the postmodern school, the idea that there is statistical regularity to the co-occurrence of words, images, and behaviors is hardly radical. The reflection of this in the culture at large seems obvious. If it were possible to gather all the texts produced by a given society and map the relationship between words and concepts within those texts, a mathematical model of meaning, at least at the linguistic level, would be in principle possible, at least insofar as that production was simultaneously coherent and comprehensible. Furthermore, we now have an indisputable existence proof for precisely such a representation in the form of so-called large language models. These AI platforms use an improbably large number of parameters, estimated by some observers at 1.76 trillion in the case of GPT-4, to specify the relationship between words and concepts that are present in the many texts that serve as training material for such models. For a variety of reasons, it is far from clear that even such an expansive textual library is sufficient to train a statistical model with an unbiased representation of the linguistic map of meaning, and this presents a major problem, both practically and theoretically. Some of that bias is a consequence of manipulation by the model's developers. Some is a consequence of favoring contemporary works in the selection of training materials, as electronic text is the most easily accessible. No such objections, however, undermine the central point. Meaning can be mapped, and the maps are not merely imaginary, subjective, or arbitrary. To say it again, the mathematically detectable landscape of linguistic meaning is made up not only of the relationship between words and then phrases and sentences, but also of the paragraphs and chapters within which they are embedded, all the way up the hierarchy of conceptualization. This implies, not least, or even necessarily and inevitably means, that there is an implicit center to any network of comprehensible meanings. The center, for example, of the words wildlife, creature, pet, fish, mammal, vertebrate, bird, reptile, insect, and amphibian is the word animal. That center of a set of associated ideas is something akin to the soul, even the god of that set. This is no dead statistical relationship between letters and words in a body of printed text. It is instead a relationship in the minds of people, in the collective metaspace of human imagination, where those related ideas are a living force or even entity. As animating, motivating, and organizing forces, these associated ideas are more like characters with aims or personalities than mere mathematical relationships. Thus, a pattern of co-occurring animating ideas can be well represented and appropriately and effectively regarded as a living spirit, dynamic and moving, rather than static and dead. Consider the words of Christ in this regard, as he insists in the gospel accounts that the word of God can be likened, for example, to a seed. In the parable of the mustard seed, Matthew 13, 31 to 32, Mark 4, 30 to 32, Luke 13, 18 to 19, the kingdom of heaven is portrayed as contained within and emerging from something small, but powerfully alive. In the parable of the sower, Luke 8, 5 to 15, Matthew 13, 3 to 23, Mark 4, 3 to 20, those who listen or fail to do so are compared to the soil. Some seed falls on the pathway, those who hear but do not understand. Some on rocky ground, those who receive the word with joy but do not endure. Some among thorns, those choked by the cares and riches of life. And some on fertile ground, those who hear, retain, and bear fruit. That theme is developed further in the parable of the wheat and the tares. Matthew 13, 24 to 30, Matthew 13, 36 to 43, which indicates that various seeds can take root in the human soul such that many, the tares or weeds, are tempted to take the pathway of the eternal adversary, while others, the children of the kingdom, Matthew 13, 38, are those who allow themselves to be possessed by the spirit of upward sacrifice that characterizes the redemptive covenant with God. It is for this reason that Christ warns against the false, contaminating, even deadly leaven of the Pharisees, Luke 12, 1, Matthew 16, 6. The members of that sect play the role of the religious hypocrites in the Passion, manipulating their tradition to put forward their own self-serving ideas, Mark 7, 6 to 9, claiming for themselves, as do Adam and Eve, the right to establish the transcendent moral order itself, and doing so for no other reason than to falsely elevate their social standing, as Christ describes in an utterly damning manner in Matthew 23. This is a sin akin to the breaking of the third commandment, Exodus 27. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain, which is not an injunction against the careless sin of speaking profanely or swearing, as is commonly presumed, but a prohibition against the much more serious error of claiming allegiance to an understanding of the divine order, while in fact pursuing only self-serving goals. It is hard to imagine a more egregious and damaging pursuit, bringing as it does nothing but the disrepute of hypocrisy to the religious enterprise itself. From evil seeds grow bitter fruit, indeed. The German philosopher George W. F. Hegel put forward a concept similarly based on associated meaning in his discussion of the Zeitgeist, a term used then and now to mean the spirit of the times. It is the Zeitgeist that gives old photos the look of their era, a style or quality that possesses everyone in that time and place as they admire and imitate one another. The same idea of living spirit, albeit in its pathological or Pharisee-like form, makes itself present in the works of the greatest commentator on the catastrophes of the Soviet era, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He illustrated precisely how the evils perpetrated by the authorities in that dread communist system were not an aberration from the hypothetically pure and moral spirit of Marxism, but a direct consequence of the poison implicit in that terrible doctrine of accusation and Cain-like envy. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Indeed, around that central idea, stake in the ground, flagpole, guiding rod, or staff, develops a network of ideas, images, and behaviors. When composed of living minds, that network is no mere system of ideas. It is instead a character expressing itself in the form of zeitgeist, a character that can and does possess an entire culture, a spirit that all too often manifests itself as the iron grip of the ideology that reduces every individual to unconscious puppet or mouthpiece. Such networks are best considered alive, transpersonal, but also personal, abstract, in that they are in part the relationship between ideas, but concrete in that they invite and can be welcomed in by the careless, prideful, and bitter, and subsequently take control of every aspect of their being. This possession by a living idea is what the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung was striving to indicate in much of his work in relationship to the idea of God, an idea hypothetically criticized to death by Enlightenment minds. This is what he meant by complex, an idea that had its roots in the free association method discovered and popularized by Sigmund Freud. It was for such reasons that Jung carved the following words in an arch over the entrance to the castle-like stone house he built by hand in Kuznacht, Switzerland, which served as his home in the latter years of his life. Vocatus atqua, non vocatus deus adorit. Called or not called, God is present. If the center of a network of ideas, a symbol in some cases, has been represented, specifically denoted by a given word or concept, called, then it has been made conscious or realized, or even made real. If it has not, or has not yet, it may well still be implicit, coded in the relationship between ideas or images or behaviors, but not yet named or subdued. This means, for lack of a better word, unconscious. Similarly, if that center once existed and had been identified, but has since been ignored, carelessly forgotten, or explicitly rejected, then it is abandoned or dead. This state of unconsciousness or abandonment is reflected, imagined, characterized, or described in an archetypal narrative trope. The hero swallowed by the beast, living a half-life in its belly, like the prophet Jonah or Pinocchio's Geppetto, the dead god Osiris in the underworld, or the god of the Judeo-Christian world whose death was so famously announced by Nietzsche. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. What is true of words, by the way, is also true of the imaginative images and dramas that guide us and that contain a further map of meaning, representing the behavioral patterns, rituals, and manners of our cultures. They have a living center, which is there whether it is acknowledged or not, and which plays a causal role in the determination of our individual and collective patterns of attention and action. And that, much as it definitely is not all. That behavioral, cultural foundation, still primarily implicit, as it is action rather than its representation in word or image, reflects the structure of the ordered and intelligible world. That world is encoded in our map in the same way that dying from walking over the edge of a bridge into the rushing river below reflects the relationship between knowledge and reality. This is the reflection of the structure of the cosmos itself in the soul of man. Thus, even when God is dead, he maintains his existence, not only in the depths, but in the patterned order of being and becoming itself. The validity of a given worldview is therefore anything but arbitrary. Instead, it is dependent on, or mirrors, the accuracy with which it reflects the natural, social, and psychological world. That coding of meaning, that representation of value, that implicit hierarchy of the likely prioritization of attention and action is, to say it again, something very much akin to the weighting of inputs that characterize our new large language models. In creating these artificially intelligent spirits, we have externalized and formalized our unconscious, even our collective unconscious, and now must contend with and benefit from the wealth of possibilities and perils resulting from that achievement. This also implies something else of revolutionary significance alluded to earlier. The collective unconscious is the relationship of concepts to one another, images to one another, and behaviors to one another, statistically considered across the whole culture, with the personal unconscious then being the lower resolution instantiation of such concepts, images, and actions in the individual person. This connection between the personal and collective unconscious helps account for the sense of revelation we experience when reading, say, a particularly profound book. That sensation is the expansion of our unconscious or implicit model of meaning as a consequence of incorporating more of the pattern or spirit that characterizes the deepest levels of the culture. In its deepest manifestation, that is precisely the reflection of the image of God that is held to typify the soul of man and woman alike in the biblical corpus, and that also constitutes the covenant between the state of chosen people and the divine. That encounter with depth, with our deeper cultural coding, is what produces that sense in the reader of, I already knew that, but did not have the words. It is the identity between the personal and the cultural that most precisely defines the enculturated or socialized person, and simultaneously allows for mutual understanding and harmonious, productive, generous community. This is the microcosm, long held to be the central feature of the human soul, and a reflection of the broader cosmic order at its deepest levels, as well as the concordance between reality and psyche, whose realization made the scientific endeavor itself both motivated and possible. This is the sharing of a pattern of understanding and action, the simultaneous possession by the spirit of the collective. If we were not imitating one another, we could not live together. But in imitating one another, we are also imitating the past, our tradition, or more accurately, the spirit of that tradition, and with God's grace, the living spirit of that tradition, and not the mere remnant patterns of its corpse. This unconscious imitation, individual and collective, is the behavioral pattern that Freud attempted to found on the narrowly sexual, a pattern well adhered to by blinkered evolutionary biologists and psychologists, and Nietzsche on the will to power, a pattern extended beyond that philosopher's wildest dreams by the postmodern neo or meta-Marxists who insist that human interaction is nothing but mutual exploitation. These two sub-deities of pleasure and power might well be regarded as the spirits that inevitably emerge to possess the culture when the higher monotheistic unity is cast into doubt. Both pleasure and power are centers of a sort and are necessary centers, but are pathological when they are raised to the ultimate position instead of serving their superordinate master in the properly subdued and appropriately humble, meek, or worshipful manner. Much of the imagery within the Book of Revelation is an exploration of the collapse into this dynamic of hedonism and force or compulsion, which is eternally emblematic of the end of times. The world cannot survive if it is ruled by sex or power. Those forces degenerate into tyranny and chaos, intertwined, intermingled, and married when they are raised to the highest place. The world of the proper sovereign order is and must be ruled instead by the pattern of encounter with chaos, upward striving, truth, and voluntary sacrifice, precisely in the manner that is most deeply and comprehensively encoded in the biblical corpus. We invite ourselves to be possessed by this deepest spirit when we voluntarily and diligently strive away from the hell of the totalitarian, or the painful meaninglessness of the nihilistic, or the self-devouring elevation of the whims of the narrow self, toward the order that is good or very good. Seeing how this spirit is reflected in a culture's deepest stories helps us understand the eternal value of the archetypal characters of the narrative world. The dragon of chaos, the great mother, the great father, and the divine son. Learning to understand and to recognize these characters wherever they make themselves manifest also enables us to appreciate the inevitability of their attractiveness and rebirth should they be forgotten or otherwise abandoned. The dragon of chaos is the plenitude of uncategorized or even unencountered possibility, that which forever exists outside the realm of experience, the greatest of possible threats, and the limitless realm of what could yet be. That dragon is the tohu vabohu over which the Spirit of God eternally and creatively broods, the watery chaos somehow extant before the emergence of the creative order. The Great Mother, by contrast, is the most primordial manifestation of that chaotic realm of possibility within the domain of what is directly experienced. This is nature itself, which is both the most basic manner in which potential reveals itself to us, as well as our experience in relationship with our own mothers, the all-encompassing love and care that is simultaneously the prerequisite for life in the most concrete sense and the biggest impediment to its independent realization when that care goes wrong. The Great Father, for his part, is the a priori structure of value, derived from the actions of the spirit that gave rise to such structure and composed of the consequences of its creative and regenerative action. He is also the eternal tyrant that can and does arise when that structure becomes outdated, rigid, or willfully blind. The archetypal individual, finally, is the hero, the active and world-engendering and renewing process of subduing and naming that is deemed by God to be the primary attribute of Adam. This is the valuing that makes perception itself possible, gives meaning to the world, participates in what is good, and constitutes the very image of the spirit that engenders the real. That hero is always and forever opposed by the adversary, the usurper, the spirit of Cain and Lucifer, who stands in prideful and presumptuous opposition to the implicit cosmic order and to its progenitor. This all means that the eternal hero, the essence or spirit of Adam, is the active process of encountering, subduing, naming, and relationship building described in the opening human drama of the great book of Genesis. Adam's individual masculine efforts in this regard, however, are insufficient, despite their central place in divine nature, as the very next phrase following his acts of naming implies. But for Adam, there was not found an helpmeet for him. Genesis 2:20. The nature of this absence was singularly well expressed by the English novelist Daniel Defoe, best known as the author of Robinson Crusoe, although also a prolific philosophical thinker and writer of the time. Defoe regarded Adam as requiring, as God himself apparently concluded, an equal, a companion, a sharer of his thoughts, his observations, his joys, his purposes, his enterprises. It was now evident from actual survey that none of these animals, even the serpent, was possessed of reason, of moral and intellectual ideas, of the faculties of abstracting and naming, of the capacities of rational fellowship or worship. They might be ministers to his purposes, but not helpers meet for him. On the other hand, God was the source of his being and the object of his reverence, but not on a par with himself in needs and resources. It was therefore apparent that man, in respect of an equal, was alone and yet needed an associate. 1.4. Eve from Adam. Eve is extracted, strangely, from Adam, a reversal in some sense of what might be expected, given that it is woman who gives birth most evidently to man. The reversal, however, drives home the creative primacy of logos working in harmony with the structure or father through which that logos operates, as well as indicating the strange dependence of that process on forces operating outside it and beyond its ken, at least in its human form. It is perfectly apropos there that Eve is derived from the unconscious Adam. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib, which the Lord God had taken from man, made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. Genesis 2:21-22. Adam has just been confirmed in his role as describer and delineator of the world. He is the locus of the differentiated consciousness upon which being and becoming themselves somehow mysteriously depend. Eve's derivation from Adam indicates her association with that very logos. Even her primal femininity is another manifestation of the Word of God, as he has fabricated her in that feminine image, as insisted upon in Genesis 1. It is also the case, of course, that any given woman is dependent on, and even in some limited manner, a creature of the social order, which is represented cross-culturally as masculine, as well as being a manifestation in the fact of her consciousness of the Word that establishes the real and the cosmic order. It is precisely this point that the postmodern gender relativists insist on when pointing to the social construction of femininity and masculinity, although they throw out the baby with the bathwater while doing so, mistaking the fact of some derivation of the feminine from the cultural with complete independence of sex and gender roles from the underlying biological and physical substrate. This does not mean that Eve's role is identical to, or is simply derived from, the naming role of Adam's. It is from the unconscious Adam, to say it again, that Eve is derived. Understanding this is key to understanding her role. She represents and speaks for what is not yet known to Adam. Given his ignorance, willful and otherwise, she has plenty to work with. Eve, as eternal feminine, draws attention to what has not yet been brought to the light of consciousness, to what has not yet been named or subdued into the social order. That is Eve's role as helpmeet, a word translated from the Hebrew, ezer kenegdo. The term ezer appears throughout the biblical texts. Applied to God, it denotes his provision of potent assistance and not in a subordinate capacity. Our soul waiteth for the Lord. He is our help, ezer, and our shield, Psalms 33:20. Psalms 115:9-11, 121:1-2, and 124:8 add to this portrayal, depicting God in this ezer role, a source of strength and aid. The word ezer is also used to characterize a military ally, Ezekiel 12:14. It suggests rescue, strength, and strategic advantage. The word kenegdo, in conjunction with ezer, helps to flesh out this characterization. It appears only as a descriptor of Eve and connotes something like striving with or aiding against. It might be most useful to consider Eve something approximating a beneficial adversary, a partner in play. Optimal development in a relationship, psychologically speaking, depends neither on stasis nor victory, but on challenge. The union of opposites that characterizes the dynamic between male and female is one of mutual trial and testing, the contest of dance or play. The optimal play partner is one whose skills on the playing field equal or perhaps even slightly exceed the skill of the would-be player. That is where the true adventure is to be found. Playing in the zone of proximal development, on the edge, on the border between chaos and order, brings the exhilaration that is a marker of continual upward development. It is to bring about this mutual improvement that Eve is created in a state of fundamental equality and partnership, and in particular, created from Adam's rib, from his side, not from his head, as Athena sprang from Zeus, which would imply a potential superiority, and not from his leg, foot, or other lower bodily part, which would imply subordination or inferiority. Eve corresponds to Adam, precisely as the Taoist yin does to yang. It is her job to bring to her partner's attention all the concerns that Adam may have overlooked, involved as he is in his enterprise of responsible stewardship. He is called upon in that work to extend, expand, and update his naming and subduing in keeping with the true and even novel needs of the time, without too radically, pridefully, or presumptuously restructuring the entire tradition. Eve's role is in keeping with the well-known personality differences between men and women, evident cross-culturally, and more pronounced in more egalitarian societies. Women are more agreeable, more concerned with others, more interested in people than in things, as well as more prone to experience negative emotion, threat, and pain, more sensitive to the things that will endanger or hurt people and cause them distress. It is this role, unfortunately, tightly tied with caring for infants and children and attending to their inchoate and subtle concerns, that also renders her arguably more susceptible to the lure of the serpent, or at least first susceptible. The story of the primal father and mother of all mankind thus outlines the major roles of the sexes within the confines of the cosmic order as they play their respective roles as dependent, created inhabitants, and autonomous creators. That is not all it accomplishes, however. The great drama of Adam and Eve in the garden also characterizes the fundamental pattern of error to which both sexes are prone. Every temperamental proclivity has its advantages and its temptations. A story that comprehensively characterizes man and woman in relationship to nature and God is therefore also necessarily going to describe both proper aim and sin. Adam orders, names, and subdues. Eve is predisposed by nature and God to speak for the oppressed, ignored, and marginalized, bringing their concerns to Adam's attention. She is well suited to this key role, being truly more sensitive in a manner that recognizes the concerns of the fragile and the not yet verbal or socialized. This allows her to play a role that is both stabilizing and exploratory, and therefore something deeply akin to the Logos itself. She stabilizes insofar as individual and social order maintain their harmony when everything vulnerable yet valuable is taken into account as much as that is possible. She explores insofar as everything ordered needs to be expanded whenever things change, when, for example, a new child has been born or a new household or relational concern has emerged, or when someone once strong and able is ill, fragile, and in need of care, however temporarily or permanently. Knowledge of Eve's essential sensitivity, her ability to serve as an alarm bell, so to speak, is also key to understanding her fundamental temptation to sin, which is to pridefully assume something approximating, I can clutch even the serpent itself, even what is irreducibly poisonous and false within my all-embracing arms. I can incorporate the fruit that the serpent offers, the mastery of good and evil, and become God himself in so doing. All of that elevates my reputation and puts that high virtue at the very center of the world. This is tantamount to the insistence that the feminine capacity for empathic tolerance and inclusion is or should be the basis of the moral order itself. That is, that what is good should be identified with what is mother to dependent infant, and simultaneously the loud proclamation that such compassion, and nothing but that compassion, is the veritable hallmark of her moral superiority, This is a true overreaching, a form of deceitful arrogance and presumption, and a manifestation of the spirit that eternally strives to usurp, hence the snake or serpent as tempter. Adam is no better. He can categorize and order the world, but he can also falsely claim expertise in doing so and ability outside his actual level of competence, and is very likely to do that to impress the eternal feminine. This is the boastful narcissism that characterizes the false masculine, indicated in characters such as Gaston in Disney's Beauty and the Beast, or far more seriously in the case of the so-called dark triad or tetrad of pathological personality traits. Adam's self-aggrandizing, arrogant, and equally usurping claim is that he can and should restructure the world so that the serpent and its fruit can be incorporated any old way and as easily as Eve, no matter how unreasonable the demands. His ethos is something akin to, I will offer whatever will impress the feminine, even if the request is overreaching, even if that offering involves the usurpation and violation of the implicit moral order as established by God. Eve pridefully embraces and incorporates too much, making a selfish show of her compassion and care. And Adam falls on his face to impress his partner, insisting that nothing she requires, wants, or demands is beyond his power. It is in these dual manners that the eternal mother and father of mankind fall prey to the cardinal sin of pride and catalyze the fall. Man and woman both incarnate the Logos, at least in potential. The pattern of being that should characterize each individual is a reflection, an imitation, and by no means a pale imitation, of what is both most real and ultimately sacred. It is on that fundamental supposition, that axiomatic belief, a claim of immense and still unrealized magnitude and significance, that man and woman rest their dignity intrinsically outside the purview of self, sovereign, state, and nature. It is on that fundamental supposition that the transcendent value of the individual is founded, that the entire edifice of rights and responsibilities that characterizes the highly functional free societies of the West is built insofar as each of those societies is truly functional and free. It is around that flag, planted in the ground, that staff of tradition, that every free individual, household, city, and state is rallied, made secure and hopeful, and united in intent, purpose, and action. Perhaps the world and everything perceptible must be founded on or centered around one central axiom, one unquestioned and central proposition of faith, one claim standing outside the issue at hand, even one miraculous occurrence. Perhaps this is true, because something has to intermediate between our always flawed and incomplete knowledge and the world of infinite mystery. Perhaps because we must wrap up and conceal from ourselves our extensive ignorance so that we can act without an infinite regress of doubt. Perhaps we need to carry with us some box never to be opened so that the Pandora of our inquiry does not undermine ourselves such that we fall forever downward. Lynn White, the historian and critic of the West referred to previously, appears to approve of the animism that rendered nature impossibly haunted, incomprehensible, and untouchable, sacred or taboo. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation. The same is true of his modern-day environmentalist or nature-worshipping descendants. The reader of such words, tempted to moralize without sacrifice, is supposed to assume uncritically that such an attitude was superior to the dominating anthropocentrism of the evil nature savaging Christians who dared place that pathetic creature, man, at the center of the world, naming, subduing, assuming the mantle of stewardship. But what is the alternative? To raise insect, rodent, tree, and shrub above the status of children? To elevate the unconscious and uncaring natural world to the status of deity? To put nature in the highest place uncritically is to denigrate man, and the consequences of that will not be good for either man or nature. Man and woman will subdue and dominate precisely because they rightly wish to live and for their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren to flourish in abundance. Any attempt to replace this central concern will end in disaster, in the worship of the ideologies or idolatries or false gods that will elicit tyranny and totalitarianism. This does not mean, to say it again, that any man or woman or all of humanity has the right to pillage in the name of narrow self-interest. Quite the contrary. As creatures formed in God's image, we have the responsibility to continue and extend the act of creation in the best manner imaginable. 1.5, in God's image. What does created in the image of God mean? It means that the human spirit exists, in its essence, on the border between order and chaos, that it serves as the mediator of becoming and being, that it shapes the manner in which new reality manifests itself, when what is old and outdated reality is crying out for redemption and renovation. The view that man's mediating capacity is central or even identical to consciousness is reflected in sources as diverse as the cosmogonies of the ancient Mesopotamians and Egyptians and the musings of modern cognitive neuroscientists. In this view, consciousness is the act of human spirit, the eternal slayer of giants and dragons, the enemy of the evil king and the devouring mother, and the force of responsible, self-sacrificing, upward striving, transformation, and movement. Why consider the thought of those ancient peoples? Because their great, populous, and enduring civilizations were the consequence of that thought. Why consider the modern scientists? Because their investigations map the natural and biological world, yet highlight a remarkable parallel with the oldest ideas we can still access. It was the duty of the ancient Mesopotamian emperor to make the spirit of Marduk, the highest god in his society's pantheon of deities, manifest in his own attentions and actions. For precisely that reason, he was held to account by his priests at the yearly New Year's ceremony of confession, repentance, battle, and renewal. It was incumbent upon him, as the embodiment of valid authority, to adopt the character of that ultimate divinity. It was in so doing and in nothing else that his sovereignty was both characterized or understood, what should rule, and justified. A good emperor was, therefore, an avatar of the spirit of Marduk, a deity who, like the god of Genesis, generated the order that was good from chaos and possibility, in consequence of the eternal battle with the primordial mother dragon of the deep, Tiamat, etymologically linked to Teom and Tohu Vabohu. The abstraction of that spirit from the previous pantheon of somehow insufficient original and primary gods constituted the precondition for the development of the abstract idea of sovereignty itself. As sovereignty is the spirit that transcends any given king, something upon which the very existence of kingship is predicated and toward which all who would properly be king must strive. Hence, Christ is traditionally Lord of Lords, King of Kings, Revelation 19:16. He is, by definition, the spirit or essence of sovereignty, its very embodiment. We know from one of the most ancient texts in our possession, the Enuma Elish, that Marduk was characterized by the Mesopotamians as the victor of the eternal battle of the gods in heaven. He was the god who emerged above all other gods, the emergent spirit who determined to voluntarily confront the monstrous, the winner of the cosmic battle who could inspire, unite, and lead others, other gods, the maker of the world from the confrontation with the serpent or dragon, and finally, the regenerator of the dissolute world. This motif of the struggle of the deities for primacy is extraordinarily widespread throughout human tradition. Why? Imagine that as tribal groups, each united under the dominion of one or several gods, we came together in the attempt to establish larger polities. Imagine that there was no shortage of battles in consequence. For primacy of drama and narrative, fought on the battleground of interest and memory, for opinion and attitude negotiated conversationally, and, when all else failed, by force, by slavery, death, and destruction. Imagine, finally, that those complex processes of consolidation can be represented as a great and never-ending conflict between the great figures of the imagination, the gods that man projected into the cosmos, battling for position and primacy in the space defined by the collective human imagination, possessing their earthly followers and acolytes, so to speak, and impelling them to do likewise. From one perspective, human beings battle with one another to establish their particular gods as superordinate. From another, gods use human beings as their earthly representatives to establish their dominion in heaven. There is much to be said for the latter frame of conception. Ideas are living spirits, as suggested previously, extant both in the collective and in the individual psyche. The terrible reality of this battleground of the divine is given voice by Gloucester in Shakespeare's King Lear. As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport. An echo of Homer in the Iliad, Book 17, lines 5:15 to 16, expressing the sentiments of Zeus. There is nothing alive more agonized than man of all that breathe and crawl across the earth. This is the terrible struggle toward unity, both of psyche and of society. The Mesopotamians knew, or at least represented in narrative, the monotheistic idea that what is deepest, ultimate and divine, was precisely the spirit of voluntary encounter with soul, society, and nature. They knew as well that any emperor worth his salt would strive to embody that spirit, and that the very survival and renewal of the kingdom depended on that striving, as I explained in my 1999 book, Maps of Meaning. The Mesopotamian emperor's identification with the most divine of all the deities, according to the judgment and election of those selfsame powers, lent him power and served to maintain social and psychological order among his people. Furthermore, the Mesopotamian emperor stood in the same relationship to his people as Marduk stood to him, as ritual model for emulation, as the personality whose actions served as pattern for all actions undertaken in the kingdom, as the personality that was the state, insofar as the state defined and brought order to interpersonal interactions, which, after all, is its primary function. Babylon was therefore conceptualized as the kingdom of God on earth, that is, as a profane imitation of heaven. The emperor served this imitated heaven as the imitator of Marduk, at least insofar as he was conservative, just, courageous, and creative. The Mesopotamians determined that the pattern for legitimate sovereignty, the spirit of voluntary confrontation, the animating principle that should be put in the highest place, was all attentive eye and magic voice. Marduk had eyes encircling his head, and he spoke the magic words that transformed, for example, night into day. That is a brilliant and inspiring vision. The idea that the God of all gods is attention and the creative transformative word, the word that transforms monstrous possibility and darkness into the world itself. Who should lead? Not the person capable of wielding the most force, not the person who is richest, not the person who can manipulate most effectively in some Machiavellian manner. Instead, the attentive visionary communicator, the person who watches most closely and tells the best story, past, present, and future. What should lead? Not power, not the immature hedonistic whim of the moment, even in its strongest sexual manifestations. Something higher. Something that genuinely brings together, establishes, names, places, and renews. Something upward striving and reflective of the truth. How might these archetypal ideas be brought down to earth? How might chaos, possibility, and their voluntary confrontation be understood in a practical sense? Let us consider the morning once again. What faces you when you awaken? Consider once again what makes itself manifest in the theater of your consciousness when the new day dawns, the promise and peril of the next 16 wakeful hours, the as of yet unshaped future. That unfolding present is neither determined nor even constrained ultimately by the past, not in any simple and predictable sense, as even the most previously stable, predictable trajectory can transform in a heartbeat and turn on a dime. Consequently, we cannot apply a set of deterministic rules and make our way forward, even in principle. No algorithm allows us to unerringly compute the transforming horizon of the future, not in a world that is not even in principle deterministic. We are called on, instead, to meet the eternal challenge of shaping, in accordance with our vision, however immature that vision may be, that which not yet is, but could yet be. We are oriented in the world toward becoming, toward what is changing and what can be changed, while everything static and fixed is rendered irrelevant and invisible, even to perception itself. I could do this. I might do this. I should do this. This is interesting to me. This is plaguing me. Things will turn out badly if I do this and not this, or well if this and not that. This is the domain of concern and care that constantly presents itself to and grips consciousness. Perhaps you face all that possibility in fear because your circumstances are too chaotic, complex beyond your competence, or so you fear. Perhaps that is in turn a consequence of the slings and arrows of fate, but possibly a function of your own inadequacy, pride, arrogance, proclivity to avoidance and deception, and subsequently resentment. Perhaps by contrast, you are enthusiastic as you perceive both possibility in the positive sense and a traversable pathway toward just that. Maybe this is because you were properly encouraged to face, confront, and explore, to challenge yourself, and because you took that responsibility onto yourself voluntarily and made it a habit of attention and action. Perhaps, finally, you allow yourself to accept that challenge right to the point of fear, so that apprehension and enthusiasm are balanced perfectly. Thus positioned, you are awake and alert, watching for trouble, but prepared to move forward, ready to parry, thrust, and dance. That means you are optimally situated. If you can play with the horizon of the future, you are indeed doing well. The horizon of the future, so encountered, is equivalent to the chaos of possibility extant at the beginning of time, portrayed in the opening verses of Genesis. We cast our visions upon the waters and bring into being, through our affinity with the Logos, through exploration, imagination, thought, and speech, the habitable world, good or even very good, in precise proportion to the accuracy of our aim. That is the continual manifestation within each of us of the divine word that generated the cosmos when time and space themselves began. That is the initial biblical characterization of the spirit of what is highest, the initial manifestation of the spirit of the one God. This is a stunning idea, a revolutionary idea, a world-ordering idea, a civilization-engendering idea, an idea that is the precondition for optimized psychological and social order alike. It is from that presumption of our implicit individual value, to say it again, that we derive our infinite set of natural rights, and let us not forget, as we are so prone to, natural responsibility. These rights and responsibilities are not bestowed upon us secondarily by some process of social contract, not granted to us by the omniscient, omnipresent, and all-powerful state. They are instead the deepest reflection of what gives rise to the enduring state and which protects it from its otherwise inevitable decline into anachronism, blindness, gigantism, and tyranny. Those rights and responsibilities are there in the beginning, like the Logos, which is their true source. They are axiomatic, the true foundation of everything, including any possible state that could possibly establish any rights whatsoever or deny them. The spirit that mediates becoming and being is therefore there in the beginning.